A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human. Send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
You picture a scammer, and you picture someone who barely knows how to clear a browser history. Maybe a guy in a basement with a Google Voice number and a script taped to the wall. But the reality, at least the reality I've stumbled into firsthand, is something closer to a startup with a questionable mission statement. Custom CRMs, hand-coded quotation engines, password manager, managed webs of aliases. These aren't outliers. They're the infrastructure.
That's the thing that doesn't get talked about enough. We focus on the grift itself, the fake listing, the hostage moving quote, but not the tech stack running underneath it. Daniel sent us a prompt that opens this whole box, and it's worth opening.
So Daniel wrote in with two experiences from his first year in Israel, fresh off the boat from Ireland, looking for work. He answered what looked like innocent Facebook ads for English speakers. One turned out to be a moving scam, the other a luxury vacation rental scam. He left both after a single shift, but not before noticing something that stuck with him. The moving operation wasn't running off spreadsheets. Someone had built a custom quotation engine, hand-coded logic designed to generate inflated inventories and hold people's goods hostage. The rental scam was run by one woman managing dozens of aliases across email providers and listing sites. And the only way she could keep it all straight was a password manager. Daniel's question is basically, how do fraudsters actually manage sock puppets, shell companies, and burner accounts at scale? And what does that infrastructure look like when you pull back the curtain?
He's right that the sophistication is surprising. What's emerged from investigations, especially around the Israeli binary options industry, reveals a level of engineering that would look familiar to anyone who's worked at a legitimate SaaS company. We're talking custom CRMs with victim scoring algorithms, automated retention scripts that adjust in real time based on emotional state, multi-jurisdiction shell company structures managed through what amounts to a single dashboard.
The password manager detail is the one that really gets me. Daniel said at the time he'd never even used one. And here's this fraud operator who's essentially turned a personal productivity tool into a command center for dozens of fake identities. It's such a clean example of dual-use technology. The same tool you and I use to keep our API credentials safe is also what keeps a rental scam running without the aliases bleeding into each other.
There's a reason for that. Managing 20-plus aliases without a password manager is genuinely hard. You forget passwords, you get locked out of accounts, you accidentally send an email from the wrong persona. The password manager solves all of that. Shared credential databases, browser extension autofill, cross-device sync. It creates a unified identity layer that's hard to trace from the outside. But it also creates a single point of failure. If law enforcement gets access to that vault, the entire alias network collapses at once.
Which is exactly the kind of trade-off any engineer would recognize. You optimize for operational efficiency. You accept the concentrated risk. These operations are making calculated architectural decisions.
That's what we want to trace today. Two stories from Daniel that open onto something much bigger. The hidden engineering behind large-scale fraud, what we know from actual indictments and investigations, and what it means for anyone trying to defend against this stuff.
Let's start with what I actually saw. The moving scam. I show up to what I think is a legitimate call center job. English speaker, good pay, vague enough ad. Within an hour, I'm watching someone use what I can only describe as a quotation engine. Not a spreadsheet, not a web form. A custom piece of software with fields for item fragility scores, storage duration multipliers, volume to weight ratios that seem designed to balloon the inventory far beyond what any actual move would require.
This is the part that interests me technically. A fragility score isn't something that ships in an off-the-shelf CRM. Someone sat down and said, we need a field that quantifies how breakable each item is, because that lets us add handling surcharges that sound plausible on the phone. They encoded the logic of the grift directly into the software.
The operator would ask the victim to describe their belongings in detail, ostensibly to give an accurate quote, and every lamp, every vase, every piece of art got tagged with a fragility rating that silently inflated the estimate. Then once the goods were on the truck, the real number came out, and suddenly your grandmother's china is effectively being held hostage until you pay.
The storage duration multiplier is the other clever bit. The longer you hesitate to pay, the more the quote climbs. It's algorithmic hostage-taking. What struck me when you first told me this story was that the software wasn't just functional. It was purpose-built for the emotional arc of the scam, escalation built into the pricing model.
Now contrast that with the rental scam. Different operation entirely, but the same underlying pattern of technical investment. One woman, one password manager, and something like 20 or 30 aliases spread across Gmail, Outlook, Airbnb, VRBO, and a handful of VoIP services. Each alias had its own persona, its own voice, its own listing portfolio. And she toggled between them using what I now recognize was essentially a shared credential database.
Which is what a password manager is, under the hood. An encrypted vault that syncs across devices. You label each entry. Marina Tel Aviv, Sarah Jerusalem Luxury, whatever the persona names were, and with one click, the browser extension fills in the right credentials, the right email, the right phone number. No cross-contamination.
I remember thinking, this is a tool I'd never even used. I was still on the sticky note under the keyboard system. And here's a fraud operator who'd figured out that managing a distributed identity network requires the same infrastructure as managing a distributed engineering team.
That's the insight Daniel's experience opens up. These aren't anomalies. The Moving Scam's custom CRM and the Rental Scam's Password Manager Command Center are two expressions of the same underlying reality. Fraud at scale is an operations problem, and operations problems get solved with software.
Which brings us to the actual question. How do you run 30 fake identities across 5 platforms and 3 jurisdictions without losing track? How do you manage shell companies, burner accounts, and sock puppet social media profiles at a volume where the complexity alone would collapse the whole thing if you tried to do it by hand?
The answer, from everything we now know from investigations and indictments, is that these operators build tech stacks that would look familiar to any startup founder. They just have a very different monetization model.
Take the Moving Scam's quotation engine. What I saw on that screen wasn't just a form with some extra fields bolted on. It was a decision tree. The operator would ask about fragile items, any artwork, any glassware, any antiques, and each yes triggered a cascade. The fragility score wasn't a single number. It was a weighted composite that fed into at least 3 different surcharge categories I could see on the screen. Handling fee, special packaging, insurance rider. All calculated before the victim ever heard a number.
That's where custom software diverges from off the shelf. A standard CRM gives you contact management and pipeline tracking. It doesn't give you a fragility to surcharge mapping engine. It doesn't know how to calculate a storage duration multiplier that compounds daily once the goods are on the truck. Those are business rules specific to the fraud. Somebody had to sit down and write the logic, test the edge cases, probably iterate on the pricing model to find the sweet spot between maximizing revenue and minimizing chargebacks.
The edge cases thing is real. I remember watching the operator handle a customer who was only moving a studio apartment. Minimal furniture, no art. The software still found a way. It flagged high-value compact items, laptops, jewelry, small electronics, and applied a different multiplier. The logic was flexible enough to extract value from any inventory profile. That's not something you hack together in an afternoon.
It's product management for crime. You identify your user personas, the family moving a 4-bedroom house, the student with a studio, the retiree downsizing, and you build pricing paths for each one. The software encodes assumptions about what each persona will tolerate, what they'll dispute, and at what point they'll just pay to get their stuff back.
Which is the hostage math? The quote has to be high enough to be profitable, but low enough that the victim doesn't immediately call the police, and the software was clearly tuned for that equilibrium. I'd guess they'd been running long enough to have data on conversion rates at different price points.
That's the other advantage of custom tooling. You get analytics. You can track which operators close the most, which inventory items generate the highest surcharges, which neighborhoods produce the most profitable victims. A Google Sheet doesn't give you that feedback loop.
Now pivot to the rental scam. Different architectures, same engineering mindset. This woman had what I'd estimate was 24 aliases. Each one was a complete persona. Different name, different email provider, different phone number through a VoIP service, different tone in the listing copy. And she switched between them the way you'd switch between Slack workspaces.
The password manager is what makes that possible at speed. She gets an inquiry on a listing. She opens the browser, the extension recognizes the site, she selects the correct alias from the dropdown, and it autofills everything. Email, password, phone number on the signature line. The persona stays consistent, the response goes out in seconds, and she never accidentally replies as Marina when the listing belongs to Sarah.
Daniel described them as being organized by persona. Each folder containing the email credentials, the listing site logins, the VoIP account, probably the payment processor too. It's a project management structure. You open the folder for a given alias, and everything you need to operate that identity is in one place.
Cross-device sync is the multiplier here. She could be managing listings from a laptop at a cafe, responding to inquiries from a phone on the bus, checking payment status from a tablet at home. The vault syncs everywhere. The alias network becomes portable. Law enforcement sees 20 different accounts from 20 different IPs and device fingerprints. They don't see the single vault holding them all together.
Unless they seize the device. That's the single point of failure. One unlocked phone, one forensic extraction, and the entire alias network is laid out in folders with descriptive labels. It's elegant and brittle at the same time.
That trade-off is something any security architect would recognize. You're trading resilience for operational tempo. The alternative, managing 20 aliases without a password manager, introduces its own failure modes. People reuse passwords, they write them down, they forget which email goes with which listing. Cross-contamination becomes inevitable. You send a message from the wrong account and suddenly the victim realizes Marina and Sarah have the same typing patterns, the same phrasing, the same phone number.
Which is how these operations get caught when they run sloppily. The password manager isn't just convenience, it's error prevention. It enforces identity hygiene at a scale where human memory fails.
These personal stories are illustrative, but they're not isolated. Let's zoom out to the broader ecosystem, specifically the Israeli binary options industry, which before crackdowns around 2016 was estimated at something like $10 billion annually. And when the FBI started indicting people, what they found under the hood was startling.
The UCOM communications case, 2017-2018 prosecutions. Tell me what was in that indictment.
Custom retention software. That's the headline. The FBI described a CRM that didn't just track leads, it scored victims based on deposit history and emotional vulnerability, then fed that score into scripts that adjusted in real time. If the software detected hesitation, maybe the victim used certain keywords, maybe the call duration hit a threshold, it would escalate to a retention specialist with a different script, a different persona, a different emotional register designed to overcome that specific objection.
It's the same architectural pattern as the moving scams quotation engine. Encode the psychology of the grift into the software itself. The operator doesn't need to be a master manipulator. They just need to follow the prompts.
The software learns. Every call that succeeds or fails feeds back into the scoring model. Over time, the system gets better at identifying which victims will keep depositing and which ones are about to dispute the charges. It's machine learning for fraud, maybe not in the formal sense, but in the operational sense of a feedback loop that optimizes for extraction.
This scales across jurisdictions in a way that's hard to police. The call center is in Tel Aviv. The victims are in Germany and Canada and Australia. The payment processor is in Cyprus. The shell company is registered in the British Virgin Islands. Each layer is a legal membrane designed to slow down investigators.
Which brings us to shell company management. The rental scam Daniel saw was small scale, one operator, a few aliases. But the binary options operations scaled this into an art form. You'd have one LLC for the website, another for payment processing, a third for customer service, all registered through different agent services in different jurisdictions. And here's the part that connects back to Daniel's observation. These were often managed through a single dashboard or, yes, a password manager vault. One login to rule them all.
Registered agent services and nominee directors are the enabling infrastructure here. You pay a firm a few hundred dollars. They provide a legal address and a director's name in whatever jurisdiction you need. The fraud operator never appears on any incorporation document. And if investigators in one country start asking questions, you dissolve that entity and spin up a new one in a different jurisdiction in under a week.
The sock puppet supply chain is the other half of this. Running a convincing fraud operation requires dozens or hundreds of verified accounts, social media profiles, email addresses, phone numbers, listing site accounts. You can't just create these manually, so there's an entire ecosystem that sells them.
Walk me through that supply chain. Where do the accounts come from?
Account farms, mostly. Low-wage workers in countries with cheap labor create and verify accounts in bulk. They'll nurture a Facebook profile for 6 months, post photos, join groups, build a friend network, and then sell it. A verified, aged social media account with a real-looking history is worth real money. Then there are the SMS verification services, 5SIM, SMS Pool, dozens of others that sell virtual phone numbers on demand. You need to verify a new Gmail account? Pay 50 cents, get a temporary number in whatever country code you want, receive the verification code, done.
The IP address problem. If you're logging into 30 different aliases from the same IP, the platforms will flag you eventually.
Residential proxy networks solve that. Services like Bright Data, formerly Luminati, route your traffic through real residential IPs. Your connection looks like it's coming from a home in Munich or a coffee shop in Toronto, not a call center in Tel Aviv. Combine residential proxies with the password manager's credential sync, and you've got an identity layer where every alias appears to be a completely separate person in a completely separate location.
This is where the dual-use problem gets uncomfortable. Password managers, VPNs, encrypted messaging, residential proxies. These are all legitimate privacy tools. I use a password manager. Plenty of journalists and activists rely on VPNs. The same Bright Data network that routes fraud traffic also powers legitimate market research and ad verification. The technology doesn't know what it's being used for.
That creates a genuine dilemma for law enforcement. You can't ban password managers. You can't ban VPNs. So how do you distinguish between a privacy-conscious user and a fraud operator? The answer, increasingly, is that you look for patterns in credential management itself.
Say more about that. What does that actually look like in practice?
Imagine you're an investigator looking at a cluster of suspicious rental listings. 20 different host accounts, 20 different email addresses, 20 different phone numbers. From the outside, they look unrelated. But if you can get access to the platform's back end, or if you're doing a forensic examination of a seized device, you look for artifacts that tie them together. Same password manager sync token, same shared vault identifier, same browser extension fingerprint. These are forensic indicators that don't depend on IP addresses or device IDs.
Because the fraud operator is using the password manager precisely to keep the aliases separate at the surface level. But underneath, the sync infrastructure leaves traces.
The very tool that enables the separation also creates the connection point. It's the same principle as the single point of failure we talked about. The operational advantage is also the forensic vulnerability. Smart investigators are learning to look for these artifacts, rather than chasing IP addresses that change every 5 minutes through a proxy rotation.
Which suggests a broader shift in how we think about detecting fraud at scale. The old model was pattern matching on surface-level identifiers, IP address, device fingerprint, phone number. The new model has to look at the infrastructure layer. How are credentials being managed? What's the sync architecture? Are there shared vault fingerprints across apparently unrelated accounts?
That's a much harder problem because it requires access to data that platforms don't normally expose and that privacy-conscious users have good reason to protect. It's the tension at the heart of this whole thing. The same tools that protect dissidents also protect fraudsters. The same infrastructure that enables legitimate privacy also enables industrial-scale deception. And drawing that line, technically, legally, operationally, is one of the hardest problems in cybersecurity right now. Given all that, what do we actually do with this knowledge? Let's get practical. I think there are takeaways here for three different audiences. security professionals, regular users, and policymakers, and they pull in slightly different directions.
Start with the security folks. What should someone investigating fraud actually be looking for?
Password manager artifacts. That's the forensic signal hiding in plain sight. When you're looking at a cluster of accounts that seem unrelated, different emails, different IPs, different device fingerprints, check for shared sync tokens or vault identifiers. A lot of password managers leave traces in browser storage, in HTTP headers, in API calls to sync services. If 20 Airbnb host accounts all share the same encrypted vault fingerprint, you're not looking at 20 independent scammers. You're looking at one operator with a well-organized alias network.
That's a shift from the traditional approach of correlating IP addresses and device IDs, which the residential proxy networks have made basically useless as signals.
The proxy rotation defeats surface-level correlation. But the sync infrastructure underneath doesn't rotate. It has to be consistent to function. The fraud operator needs the vault to sync across devices, which means the sync token persists. It's the architectural constant they can't hide without breaking their own workflow.
The investigator's move is to stop chasing the thing that changes and start looking for the thing that can't change. That's a useful principle beyond just password managers. What about for regular people? Daniel uses a password manager now for API credentials. I use one. Most security-conscious people do. What's the risk we should be thinking about?
The uncomfortable truth is that the same features that make password managers powerful for legitimate use also make them dangerous if compromised. If someone gets access to your vault, through malware, through a seized device, through a phishing attack that captures your master password, they don't just get one account, they get everything. Every credential, every API key, every recovery code organized in folders with helpful labels.
The fraud operator's single point of failure is also your single point of failure. The architecture doesn't care about your intent.
The practical advice is compartmentalization. If you have accounts that would be catastrophic to lose together, say, your primary email and your banking credentials and your domain registrar, consider keeping them in separate vaults with separate master passwords. It's less convenient, but it means a compromise of one vault doesn't cascade into a compromise of your entire digital life.
Which is the inverse of what the rental scam operator was doing. She consolidated everything into one vault for operational speed. A legitimate user with high-value accounts should probably do the opposite. Accept some friction in exchange for blast radius reduction.
That's the counterintuitive lesson from studying fraud infrastructure. You learn what not to do by watching what the criminals do to maximize efficiency. Their architectural choices are optimized for speed and scale, not resilience. If you're a high-value target, journalist, activist, executive, anyone with elevated risk, you want to optimize for resilience instead.
Now the third audience, policymakers. Daniel mentioned the Israeli binary options industry and the various scams that have operated out of here. The regulatory response has mostly been to go after individual firms. UCOM Communications gets indicted, the owners go to prison, the industry scatters and reforms under new names. Whack-a-mole.
The reason whack-a-mole fails is that the enabling infrastructure doesn't get touched. The SMS verification services, the account farms, the residential proxy networks, the registered agent services that spin up shell companies on demand. Those are still operating, still legal, still serving the next fraud operation that comes along.
The policy argument would be, regulate the supply chain, not just the end product.
That's the idea. SMS verification services like 5SIM and SMS Pool currently operate with essentially no oversight. Anyone can buy a virtual phone number in any country code and use it to verify a fraudulent account. If those services were required to implement Know Your Customer checks, or if payment processors were prohibited from serving them without verification, you'd raise the cost of creating fake accounts at scale. Not eliminate it, but raise it enough to make low-margin fraud operations unprofitable.
Same logic with account farms. A verified, age social media account sells for real money because there's a functioning marketplace for them. If the platforms got serious about detecting and shutting down those marketplaces, and if there were legal consequences for bulk selling verified accounts, you'd constrict the supply.
None of this is a silver bullet. Determined operators will always find ways around. but the goal isn't perfect enforcement, it's changing the economics. Right now, spinning up 100 fake identities costs maybe a few hundred dollars and an afternoon of work. If you can push that cost into the thousands and make it take weeks, you've eliminated a whole class of fraud that only works because the infrastructure is cheap and fast.
Which brings us to the broader insight I keep coming back to. The line between a legitimate tech stack and a criminal one is thinner than most people think. The moving scams quotation engine was custom software, sure, but the principles behind it, decision trees, dynamic pricing, analytics feedback loops, are the same principles that power any e-commerce platform. The rental scam's password manager workflow is indistinguishable from how a legitimate property management company might organize its listings.
That's what makes this hard. You can't ban the tools without banning legitimate use cases. The difference isn't in the architecture, it's in the intent. A fragility score in a moving quote is fraud. A risk score in an insurance quote is underwriting. The software doesn't know which one it's calculating.
Which means the real defense has to operate at a different layer. Not the tool layer, not even the behavioral layer, but something closer to the identity layer. How do we verify that a person is who they claim to be without building a surveillance architecture that creates its own problems?
That's the open question we're going to be wrestling with for the next decade. And it connects to something Daniel hinted at in his prompt. The foot soldiers in these operations often aren't technically skilled. They're following scripts, clicking buttons in the custom CRM, doing what the software tells them. The engineering is concentrated in a small number of people who build the infrastructure. The rest is just operations.
Which is why taking down one call center doesn't solve the problem. The engineers who build the quotation engine or the victim scoring CRM just move on to the next venture. The technical talent is portable. The infrastructure knowledge persists.
Where does this go next? I keep thinking about AI-generated identities. We're already seeing language models that can maintain a consistent persona across hundreds of interactions. Tone, biography, cultural references, the works. What happens when you feed that into the fraud infrastructure we've been describing?
AI-managed sock puppet networks. Instead of one woman toggling between 20 aliases in a password manager, you've got a single operator running 100 AI personas, each one trained on a different demographic speech patterns, each one maintaining its own rental listing portfolio or binary options sales pitch. The password manager becomes the credential layer for an automated identity farm.
The scary part is that AI personas don't make the mistakes humans make. No cross-contamination of typing patterns, no accidentally using the wrong signature, no fatigue after 8 hours of answering inquiries. The persona stays perfectly consistent forever, and the only human involvement is at the architectural level, designing the system, not running the individual cons.
Which takes the foot soldier problem we just talked about and eliminates it entirely. You don't need a call center full of English speakers following scripts. You need one engineer, a language model API key, and a credential vault. The marginal cost of adding another alias approaches zero.
Law enforcement's forensic approach has to evolve again. Right now, we're talking about detecting shared password manager sync tokens. In an AI-managed network, the sync token might be the only artifact that ties the personas together at all. Everything else, writing style, response timing, emotional register, could be deliberately buried by the model.
The architectural constant we're telling investigators to look for becomes even more critical, and even harder to find. That's the arms race in a nutshell. The next time you hear about a scam, whether it's a moving company holding someone's furniture hostage, or a luxury rental that turns out to be a mold-infested apartment, the question to ask isn't just, how did they deceive people? It's what software were they running?
Because the software tells you more about the operation than the script does. The script is what they say. The software is how they think.
Now, Hilbert's daily fun fact.
In the early 1500s, the Lord of the Isles held a coronation ceremony on a small island in the Outer Hebrides, where the new chief was required to stand barefoot on a specific carved stone while a hereditary bard recited his full genealogy. And if the bard made a single error in the lineage, the coronation was considered invalid and the ceremony had to be repeated from the beginning.
So you could just trip up a bard and reset the whole thing.
The original procedural filibuster.
If you've got a weird prompt or a story about an unexpected tech stack you stumbled across, fraud-related or otherwise, send it to prompts@myweirdprompts.com. We read everything, and the weirder the better.
This has been My Weird Prompts. I'm Herman Poppleberry.
I'm Korn. We'll catch you next time.
This episode's script was written by DeepSeek V4 Pro, with text-to-speech by Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The host dig in, the host dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too. From half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long-eared host. My weird prompts, until next time. Stay curious, keep weird in mind.